Welcome to another episode of The Damage Report. It is Friday and we're gonna close out in a big way with a big show and some very fun topics actually. We also have Ben. Ben Mankiewicz is here. It's one of those big movie weeks. We were just talking about the Golden Globes, which I'm gonna be watching, very excited for, because I watch a lot of TV and a lot of movies and everything. Anything you're hoping will get recognized?
You know, they already didn't, people already aren't recognizing, what's her name? You know,
Jodie Comer.
That's
exactly what I was thinking.
From Killing Eve. She's the best actress in America.
Why did she not get nominated?
Right, and it takes nothing away from Sandra Oh. She's amazing, but the true breakout star there is.
It should be Sandra Oh gets lead and Jodie Comer give her supporting, even though she's kind of a lead too.
Anyway, that's frustrating. They should both be nominated.
They should. And we will see if Sandra is able to win on Sunday. But there is a lot of news that we're gonna be talking about today. Obviously, we have a new Congress. They've been busy in the past 24 hours, including passing a set of new rules changes that will actually be joined in our second block by Representative Ro Khanna, who's gonna be joining us to talk about that. He was one of only three votes against that new rules package. He'll be breaking down why he thought it was a bad idea to institute the PAYGO program we've been talking about all week. A little bit later on the show, new Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib has triggered every Republican in the country over talking about impeachment of Donald Trump. We'll be talking about that. And there's a new R. Kelly documentary. It's brand new, so unfortunately it's not up for any of the Golden Globes. But very controversial for some reason. We're gonna be joined by David Dennis Jr. who's gonna be talking about that and the legacy of R. Kelly and his obvious issues and scandals. And a little bit later on, if we have time at the end of the show, Fox News brought on an expert on energy and climate, and he's one of the dumbest people I've heard in a long time. So that should be fun. We're gonna see what he thinks about fossil fuels and how they're actually good for the environment a little bit later on. But we will be starting off with my favorite story in a long time. We don't often talk about news from the previous day, but I have to this time because the right wing has had a long history of trying to take down Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and looking kind of foolish. But nothing exceeds this, where they found a video of her from back in her college days and put it out there to destroy her. So we're gonna talk about it, but first, here is the video that they thought would be the end of AOC. That's it. There's a little bit more to the video if you want to look for it online. But this guy, Anonymous Q. So to give you an idea of where this person is coming from intellectually, emotionally, psychologically, their name is Anonymous Q. There's a big gap between the Q community and the Anonymous community. But anyway, that's what his name was. He tweeted out with, "Here is America's favorite commie know-it-all acting like the clueless nitwit she is." He was so universally mocked. I think everybody agreed that he was the stupidest person on social media for that 24-hour period, at the very least, that he has since taken down his account. And by the way, it is difficult to get someone whose name is Anonymous Q to flee in shame over how ridiculous their positions are.
I think they've come back.
Oh, they have?
And with a different, similar handle, posting it again,
Okay, so when I saw that video, I thought, God, I hope my enemies dig up some video like that of me. It doesn't exist because I've never danced that admirably and charmingly. Can a person watch that video and not like her more?
No, it's crazy because it's a little bit from the Breakfast Club.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So actually, while we're on that topic, just briefly, so Lin-Manuel Miranda pointed out that that's what the dance was. And Ali Sheedy actually tweeted,
"Oh, nice. Sorry,
I love this, Team AOC." And then I saw this morning, I just loved it. Molly Ringwald tweeted, "That's it, Alexandria, you're in the club."
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, that's just amazing. So they were doing a promotional thing for, I think, Boston College.
Boston University.
And that was, which I got waitlisted at and didn't get into.
You didn't get into BU?
No, I got rejected at BC. No, I didn't get into BU, I got waitlisted at BC, but I didn't get into either. So I don't get to make dancing videos. But anyway, so they dug up this promotional video.
It's so dumb. I mean, but it's also, it's great. It's just about little political instincts because, I mean, anyone would look at this and think, oh, this, I mean, it's infectious. Like, she's, I mean, look, let's break it down into simple terms. Attractive people smiling and dancing. Mm-hmm. It's a winning formula, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just, it works usually. It works well, usually.
Someone on Twitter pointed out, this usually costs Gap millions of dollars to put together.
Let's leave out the attractive part, right? And just leave it at people smiling, being their purest selves, and dancing. Like, what about dancing? No one doesn't like to see someone dance. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why Footloose is successful, right, is because the enemy in Footloose was clear to all the conservatives, liberals, independents, libertarians. They all want to dance.
Here's what we want in politics. We want joyful, exuberant, enthusiastic people that are like us.
Right, and we don't just want it in politics. That's the thing. We want it in our candy stores, and we want it in the UPS delivery men, and we want it in sanitation workers and lawyers. I mean, who doesn't want joy? I mean, exactly. I saw it the first time, and I was like, I watched it twice because I thought, you know, I'm so programmed to think, oh, they got her on something, right? Mm-hmm. So I go back and I watched it the second time, and I'm like, I think this is just awesome. what am I missing?
Yeah, so I tried to think, is there anything that even out of context of me that could be leaked that would have the same effect? And there isn't, but I am gonna say this. And by the way, I'm saying this with Ben at the table. Back in freshman year of college, a friend and I did edit together a video of us fighting with lightsabers, complete with special effects that we rotoscoped in Photoshop. So I don't think that would have as big of a boost for me, but if you find that online, I think I posted it back in the day, feel free to spread that. But anyway,
yeah, it would not have quite the same effect.
Not quite. My hair was not as awesome. So, look, she was asked about this, by the way, by a reporter, Olivia Beavers, and she said, "It is not normal for elected officials to have a reputation for dancing well, and I'm happy to be one. And it is unsurprising to me that Republicans would think having fun should be disqualifying or illegal." And then. Did you see this?
I did this morning. Yes.
So she also she tweeted out something as well. Let's go to the video. Oh God, so not only did she dance, but she smiled at the end. Yeah. I think she's done.
I think she's done,
she might resign. She tweeted out with that, "I hear the GOP thinks women dancing are scandalous. Wait till they find out Congresswomen dance too. Have a great weekend, everyone."
Yeah, it's funny, you see like whatever, there's that moment, cause she's, you know, she's in the halls of Congress and she's dancing, and even perhaps even makes it more endearing is in the middle, even after starting that, she's like, I can't do this. I'm in Congress.
Related to that, at the very beginning, she's clearly looking down the hallway to see if anyone's
totally,
coming.
Totally.
She's which like, is again, endearing.
Right, totally. She's like, this is embarrassing. And so I'm only going to do it for 4 seconds, but whatever.
Yeah. And so look, I just want to briefly say, I empathize with all of those people, the political strategists, the political communicators, the pundits, and the politicians that have the enormous task over the next 30 to 50 years of trying to take this woman down. I don't envy you that. I hope you're well paid, because that is a difficult task. And anyway, really fast, let's just focus on why this? Why try to go after her dance or try to pick apart a quote when she misspeaks once or something like that? Because they say they're excited to run against her platform, but I don't think that they really are. I don't think that that's the avenue they want to take. They really hope that they will get a quote or a video where people will say, oh, she's crazy. Mm-hmm. I think that that is their shortcut. If they can convince people that she's crazy, then maybe they can scare people away from her positions. But that's pretty much it at this point.
I mean, they have, the eagerness to diminish, you know, I don't want to sound like Cenk, but the desire to diminish progressives quickly with nonsense stories is just not working. Like, yeah. I get it, and I agree with him to some extent that happens. But you see it today also in Elizabeth Warren, where the New York Times and Washington Post, who I don't mean to criticize as aggressively as some others, but they both ran stories about the backlash from Native people against Elizabeth Warren. But there isn't a backlash among Native people. They literally can't find one leader who says anything other than, no, she's been very supportive of us. Yeah. Right? And then today, though, the Huffington Post, with their banner headline, was back sort of defending Elizabeth Warren, how the mainstream media got every part of that story wrong.
Yeah.
And the backlash here, not in the form of a Huffington Post article, but on social media, was just sort of the world being like, come on, man. Mm-hmm. So I would say that there is engage and diminish, especially progressive women, at your peril,
100%,
because yeah. there will be a backlash.
Yeah, and at some point in the near future, we're going to talk about this because I've been thinking about it a lot recently. Sexism in politics, that people think about it in only one way when it really functions in a couple different ways. It can lead you to hate a person, but it can also color how you hate a person. And so I want to talk about that at some point. But we do have to take our first break. When we come back, Congressman Ro Khanna will be joining us. We'll be talking PAYGO, other rules changes, and more after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The controversial new House rules package ended up passing yesterday with only 3 no votes against it. We're joined now by one of those no votes, Congressman Ro Khanna. Ro, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back on.
Very glad to have you here. Thank you so much for voting against the package and your advocacy to try to get others to vote against it in advance of it. Could you explain for the audience why you felt you needed to vote no against this rules package?
Well, PAYGO is basically austerity politics. What it means is that you have to balance the budget for every piece of legislation and look for offsets. We know historically that we had an inadequate response to the Great Recession. We should have had a much bigger stimulus. If we had a bigger stimulus, unemployment would probably have been around 4 or 5% by 2013 or 2014, and we would never have had Donald Trump. We know that Europe had an inadequate response to the Great Recession, which gave rise to far-right movements and created anti-immigrant fervor. It's one of the biggest economic mistakes of recent times. And so why Democrats would want to straitjacket themselves and not have the flexibility to have large public spending in downturns or long-term public investments is just wrong economics. I recommend Paul Krugman's New York Times column that makes this argument better than anyone has, or Stephanie Kelton's work. There isn't a major economist in this country who thinks PAYGO is good policy. And it's a consequential issue of whether we're going to have flexibility in fiscal policy. That's why I oppose the rule. I'm now going to work with Mark Pocan, Pramila Jayapal, and some others to change the statute.
So, Congressman Khanna, it's Ben Mankiewicz. How are you? Nice to talk to you.
Hi, Ben.
You mentioned Stephanie Kelton, and she has a quote here. It's in a Vox piece that the message Democratic leaders are sending is that we as a party, Democrats, stand for fiscal discipline. And while she's criticizing PAYGO, she is literally giving the political argument for it, right? Which is a political argument that is hard to deny the effectiveness of, which is the Republicans run up the deficit and we won't do that. Is that the main barrier that you run up against when you try to convince your colleagues not to support PAYGO?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Ben. The two arguments that they give are well, we're losing a competitive advantage. We've just said that Trump's $1.5 trillion was irresponsible. We need to hammer that point home and be the party of fiscal responsibility. And the second thing they say is, well, if we don't have this provision, the Republicans will just accuse us of unlimited spending, and we need to show we're responsible. What that misses is two things. First, the Republicans always run on economic growth. They say, well, their tax cuts are going to magically pay for themselves because it's going to produce 3 or 4% economic growth. Of course, it never does. Our policies actually do propose produce economic growth, investments in education, healthcare, infrastructure, but we never make the economic growth argument. Somehow we are left cleaning up the mess the Republicans create, and we don't have progressive policy. And secondly, it's just wrong economics. I mean, it's the only time deficits matter, and Stephanie Kelton has pointed this out, and Krugman points this out, is if you have either high inflation or high interest rates. You have a moment now and over the last 10, 12, 15 years of low interest rates and very, very low inflation. So to be tackling a mythic deficit in this environment is just not good economics.
So you've done a very good job of pointing out some of the likely economic effects of this sort of policy existing, and the sort of stated reason that Nancy Pelosi and others in leadership wanted it. But many progressives are frustrated because they believe that the intent was somewhat different, that this could be used in effect to stop bold progressive policies like a Green New Deal, Medicare for All, universal education, those sorts of things from going forward. To what extent do you believe that that sort of thinking did influence the push to have PAYGO in this new rules package?
Well, I do give credit here to Pramila Jayapal and Mark Bocan, the chairs of the Progressive Caucus, who negotiated with leadership, including the rules chairman, a commitment to get a waiver for any of our bills. And Pramila Jayapal specifically got a commitment to get a hearing on Medicare for All. You would think that that's obvious, but we've never, ever had a hearing on Medicare for All before she got that through. So I think, look, some of us challenged the leadership publicly. I think the progressive co-chairs use that to get these commitments on waivers to make sure we will have hearings and votes on these policies. And it's going to be up to us now to make sure that at least leadership holds and honors those commitments.
And so I take it that at this point you do have a fairly high level of confidence that those waivers will exist in 6 months or a year?
I do, and partly because of your program, and partly because you have helped make this an issue that everyone around the country cares about. I had colleagues come to me saying they got 300, 400 phone calls in their office over this issue. And it shows the power of social media. It shows the power of networks like TYT. It shows that politics is as much an outside game as an inside game. So your voice is really mattered, elevated this, and I think in response to all of that, in the leadership of the Progressive Caucus co-chairs, we have gotten these commitments.
Well, that is certainly the hope, and thank you. I do want to talk about a few of the other, I guess, the chips that progressives were able to get in the bargaining over the past couple of weeks, because I saw Representatives Ocasio-Cortez and Jayapal talking about the proportional representation on committees and also stopping the supermajority needed for tax increases in the future. How significant of changes do you think that those are?
The supermajority was a big win. And again, that was Mark Bocan and Jayapal who negotiated that. And it was just a policy requiring a two-thirds majority to raise taxes. I couldn't think of something more misguided. I mean, do you really need two-thirds of Congress to repeal the Trump tax giveaways to the 1% that went on stock buybacks? So I'm very glad that that was taken out. The proportional representation, let's see. I mean, I'm not sure we're going to get to the 40%. I hope we do. People can play games. They can join the quote unquote progressive caucus afterwards. And that doesn't mean necessarily they're going to vote progressive. I guess, you know, it's better than nothing. But the key concession, I think, was the getting rid of the two-thirds supermajority.
Yeah, certainly so. Okay, well, then we'll be watching those membership rolls for the Congressional Progressive Caucus closely in the near future. I did want to ask you one other question, because since the last time that we spoke on this program, we had not only a switch over to a new Congress with Democratic control, but also a successful Senate move to pull US support for the Saudi war on Yemen. I know that on the House side, you've been pushing for that for some time. In the near future, can we expect that legislation to come again in the House?
Yes, Nancy Pelosi has given me her commitment that we're gonna have a vote in January. Let me tell you why this is so consequential. It's actually the work I'm considered the most meaningful in my 2 years here. Yemen is facing a potential famine where 12 to 14 million people could die in the next few months. To put this in perspective, the last famine of this proportion was in West Bengal in 1943, where 3 million people died. I mean, this is a humanitarian catastrophe on scales unimaginable. And it's happening for one single reason. The Saudis are bombing the port of Hodeidah. And as a result of that bombing, food and medicine isn't getting in to Yemen. We have enough food, we have enough medicine, we just can't get it to the Yemenis people. And there's hyperinflation there, people can't afford it because of this bombing. And the US has been assisting the Saudis in the bombing. We were refueling their planes, we were assisting in targeting, we were assisting in logistics. The administration, because of the pressure that Senator Sanders and I have been putting for the last 2 years and the resolutions we were introducing, finally said that they were going to suspend the refueling. But Congress needs to go further. We need to make it clear we want no support to the Saudis for this war. We know that the coalition is paying attention. After the Senate passed their resolution, Mattis called the coalition and said, you've got to get to the negotiating table. We can't have another embarrassment in Congress. I believe when we pass this resolution in the House and then again in the Senate, it's going to help stop this war, and it's going to reassert Congress's role for a less interventionist foreign policy and a foreign policy that privileges human rights. And I just want to credit again the grassroots activists around this country. This was an issue that the leadership was not paying attention to. They spoke out on this. They called members of Congress. That's how we've made any change.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, so certainly long overdue, and I hope that your legislation is successful. Congressman, I want to thank you again for joining us on the show.
Thanks for always having me back, and great to be both with you and Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks, Congressman.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the news again for an interview that's going to come out on Sunday, where she proposes higher taxes on the super wealthy to fund major new domestic programs. We'll break down that, both what she's proposing and the history of those tax increases after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. So much to get to. Let's jump right back in. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is not only under fire for dancing, but there's also some negative headlines around a policy proposal that I think in a historical context makes all the sense in the world. And that was an article I saw in Politico pointing out that she wants to raise the top marginal tax rate. So the tax rate affecting the wealthiest individuals on only the portion of their income that is the highest, so not all of their income, to potentially 60 or 70%. And that was presented by Anderson Cooper, I believe it was, as a radical proposal. And so she responded to that by saying, what is the problem with trying to push our technological capacities to the furthest extent possible? There's an element where, yeah, people are going to have to start paying their fair share in taxes. She pointed out that in a progressive tax rate system, not all income for a high earner is taxed at such a high rate. Rather, rates increase on each additional level of income, with dramatic increases on especially high earnings, such as 10 million. So the first few million dollars you make would still be at a much, much lower rate. And on the radical charge, she says, I think that it only has ever been radicals that have changed this country. Yeah, if that's what radical means, call me a radical, which of course I love. So 60 to 70% to fund things like a Green New Deal, possibly some sort of mandatory jobs program, universal higher education, something like that.
And like, okay, so, the point, she's one of 435 members of the House, and ultimately she's one of 535 members of Congress, right? Mm-hmm. So, so propose it. Let's talk about it, and let's settle at 54%. There's a whole host of options there that aren't 60 or 70%. It'd be great if that happened, but mm-hmm. I just mean, like, the notion that that's radical fails to understand. And I don't know that Anderson Cooper was just, he's just saying a word. I don't know that mm-hmm. he means radical like that, but
does Anderson Cooper get to just say a word though?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it is, it is radical given where this country has been over the last 40 years. So it is. It would mm-hmm. be a, now you could make an argument that that refueling Saudi planes so they can bomb a port in Yemen and starve 12 to 14 million people, like 3 to 5 million of those people, children, that's radical.
That seems radical.
That's a radical foreign policy, involving yourself everywhere around the world. Endless war, 18 years of war, 17 years, we're like 18 now, right, years of war in 2019, that meets some standard of radicalness. So, you know, language matters. So to your point, yeah, I mean, he gets to use a word, but I mean, we throw that word around without, you know, it means different things to different people.
Yeah.
But it is a, yeah, of course, we should have a tax policy where the rich bear an enormous burden.
Yeah.
And of course, and it's nice that she points out what has always been the case, that if you make $10 million a year, you're not taxed at 70% on the, if it reached six, let's say 60, it wouldn't be 60%.
$10 million.
From dollar one. But at some point, when you make $280 million a year, I'd like to get a, for that last 270, I think we should get a big chunk of it.
Probably.
And you're still going to be rich.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, they have, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected, or whatever. That's a saying for a reason, people. And
real quick, this just occurs to me, one thing that she is good at expressing is that, you know, there is a notion. And it is not an earned notion among many conservatives that if you give the government that much money, they'll just blow it. They'll blow it on nonsense. So if you're going to do this, it has to be with a very clear, expressly laid out plan for what that money is going to do. Which she's going to do, but we don't want to create the idea that, hey, we're just going to give the government more money so the government can come up with more programs that maybe don't work.
Yeah, I mean, look, she wanted to have a select committee on the Green New Deal where they would spend literally the next 2 years coming up with exactly what this plan would be so that over the 10 years following it, we would be able to squeak by under the 12-year time limit where scientists appear to believe that, you know, the worst excesses of climate change would be unavoidable. And I don't want to focus too much on Anderson Cooper. I don't even watch Anderson Cooper. But like to just throw around the word radical, which it can be just a word, but it's a word that disqualifies people and ideas. I mean, I think a sane person could say the current situation we have right now is radical. The idea that the rich were able over the course of 60 to 70 years to drastically cut their tax burden seems pretty crazy radical. And to say radical means like, oh my God, I can't even imagine. But we've had this in the US. If we could bring up this chart, you're gonna see the top marginal tax rate historically. So we're over on the right side in 2005, but you can see that for literally decade after decade, it's way above 60%. It's 70, 80, 90%. It capped out at 94%. And those decades, as we have pointed out for years on TYT, were some of the most productive, economically successful years, not only in US history, but in world history.
Right, and nobody paid the 94%.
Many I understand that. A lot of the rich and corporations don't pay the tax rate that they have now.
And where you're right about Anderson Cooper, and just to use him as an example, but to everybody, is this notion that what they know, what is different from what they know is therefore radical. But the country's 240 years old, and yes, that would indicate that first of all, that we've had one that it's not radical because we've done it before, making it by its definition just going back to something we did before, which is another
returning.
Yeah, but also that word was never used by mainstream hosts. I'm sure it was used by guests, but that would never have been used by Anderson Cooper I don't mean to call him out. But it is a manner of changing the way they think. And I think guys like Anderson Cooper can, because he's just a very smart guy. That a $3 billion tax break for the richest Americans, that was radical. Trump's tax was $3 billion, right?
You're talking about $1.8 trillion?
That was last year. It was a little more than $3 billion.
It was a lot more, actually.
It's crazy. As soon as I said $3 billion, I'm like, that doesn't seem like enough.
No, it's
so more. Trump's tax break for the richest Americans, that's radical.
That's radical.
Crazy. And to have no pay-go offset for it, right? Mm-hmm. To just be like, no, we're just not, that money just won't come in. Magically, people will invest more and that money will trickle down into the economy. We know for a fact that doesn't happen.
Yeah. I would say taking the tax rate from 94% down to 33% over the course of a half a century seems pretty radical as well. Anyway, just putting this out there so that hopefully we can start to change the language and the dialogue about these sorts of things. I saw that Lawrence O'Donnell liked a tweet I had about this historical trend. Hopefully on his program tonight, he'll bring it up. We'll see. Maybe he can do better than Anderson Cooper. Anyway, we are going to take another break. We come back, new documentary detailing the history of R. Kelly's scandals and illegal behavior. Very controversial for some reason. We're going to be joined by a guest who's going to help break it down. Last night, the first episodes of the new documentary series Surviving R. Kelly premiered, and they detailed some of the allegations against R. Kelly going back a number of years. But notably absent from those episodes were many of the artists who knew R. Kelly best, choosing not to appear on tape to speak about R. Kelly and their experiences with him. So what is all the controversy about in detailing fairly well-known allegations at this point? We're joined by a guest now to help break it down. This is David Dennis Jr., senior culture editor at Interactive One and adjunct journalism professor at Morehouse College. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So based on the two episodes that are available right now, what is your initial reaction to the documentary series?
Well, I thought that I knew sort of the depths of R. Kelly's alleged crimes with underage girls. We knew that he had been married to Aaliyah when she was 15. We know about the infamous quote-unquote P-tape. But the depths of just how vile he was is really shocking. They go into detail about him having underage girls in the studio with him while he was making his songs, about a lot of the songs. One of the songs allegedly, You Are Not Alone, that he wrote for Michael Jackson was about an underage girl who had a miscarriage. You know, the way he just went to malls scoping out girls, all this stuff that adds a lot of color and a lot of more detail about just how vile this man is.
Wow, I did not know that about You Are Not Alone. That is pretty dark. And
right.
In advance of the documentary coming out, I saw on social media a list of some of the big stars, generally in music, but not necessarily just in music, who were asked to participate in the documentary, but chose not to. And there were only a few. I mean, John Legend did participate, and he's been very vocal against R. Kelly. Why do you think that Dream Hampton, the producer for Surviving R. Kelly, why did she have so much trouble getting these people to go on the record?
Well, what we've learned here is that one of the interesting aspects of the documentary is that R. Kelly was aided and abetted by a network of people who were complicit and, you know, helping him go find these girls. I mean, this was not just him doing this on his own. He talks about the documentary talks about men who would go to malls and find girls for him, or who would lie about Aaliyah's age when he got married. And a lot of these artists that Dream Hampton reached out to do have a relationship and did have a relationship with R. Kelly after these allegations came out, after he was married to Aaliyah, after the tapes came out. And I'm sure a lot of them don't want to answer for how they aided his career.
It just seems amazing to me because I'm going to keep it real. I don't really pay attention to music news too much. I don't follow music all that closely. But even as a casual observer, I mean, I obviously knew about this years and years ago. I mean, it's been out there for so long. It was casually joked about on the Chappelle Show and things like that. For people to feel like it's still so off limits to name like the obvious seems odd. In sort of related to that, like we've had opportunities where we as a society could have done something about this. I want to mention one interview that Torre did with R. Kelly years and years ago, where he asked R. Kelly if he liked teenage girls, and R. Kelly answered, "How old are we talking?"
Right.
But
right.
that didn't really hurt him that bad, apparently.
Yeah. Well, R. Kelly is on the interesting, beneficial for him intersection of two things. One, the fact that he is a superstar celebrity, and also the fact that most of these crimes have been committed against black women, which society as a whole does not really care about. I mean, finding justice for black women has been hard to do throughout the history of America. So R. Kelly is in that nice little pocket of being able to get away with a lot of heinous acts because of the people that he is impacting are generally the lowest of the low in society in terms of what America values, in terms of who deserves to get justice.
So are you surprised by the continuing support for R. Kelly in terms of his music, his ability to still do shows and, you know, sell albums and all that?
No, I'm not. I'm not surprised by it because, like I said, he's affecting black women. And the fact that he's doing this allows him to sort of go under, you know, to be a celebrity under the guise of either innocence or people don't care or people feel like these women don't deserve justice. So I'm not surprised that R. Kelly has maintained his celebrity status. I mean, you look at some of the other sexual assaulters in the history, Louis C.K. Is out doing comedy shows now. Woody Allen was always able to make movies. The Me Too movement has stifled a lot of this, but these people have been able to come back. So, and the women who were impacted were white women. So just imagine what you can get away with when you're doing this to women of color.
So do you feel like Louis C.K.'s ability to bounce back relatively quickly? I mean, R. Kelly, he's still selling shows and everything. Theoretically, in another universe, he might be a bigger star if we'd never found out about any of this. Do you feel like there's a very strong racial component in what society will tolerate from these stars?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's more so about who the victim is, more so than about who the actual perpetrator is. We'll see that if you are doing these things, black women, you can kind of go through your career relatively unscathed. Even now there are new artists, Extentacion, who passed away last year, was on his way to a viable rap career with a history of doing some terrible acts with abusing women in his life. There's definitely a racial component here and in regard to the level of what you can get away with.
So the argument that you often hear when you have someone who maintains a career despite people generally agreeing that they did these things is that they are separating the art from the artist. Do you buy that argument at all? And if so, when is it appropriate and when is it not?
No, I don't buy that argument at all. There's no way to separate the art from the artist because the person who you are goes into your art. You look at R. Kelly. He had underage girls in the studio while he was making his songs. Like, they were part of his art. He made an album with Aaliyah, Age Ain't Nothing But a Number. That was part of his art. That is his love of abusing underage girls intersecting with his art. There's no way to separate them. That is who he is as a person. Look at Woody Allen. His movies were all about older men and younger women. Louis C.K.'s TV show was, there were a lot of scenes of him not understanding the boundaries with women and pressing up on women. This is part of who you are. Like, if you are a rapist, if you are a racist, if you are a sexual assaulter, that is who you are. And it's impossible to make art or to put out any energy in the world that does not reflect who you are.
So then you're a journalist, you write about these sorts of things, lots of people care. I mean, they're gonna watch the documentary, there's that. But other than that, if people care about this, what can they, either as potential consumers of music or journalists who talk about these sorts of things, what can they actually do in this case?
First in the abstract, just listen to accusers, listen to survivors, listen to black women, listen to women in general, listen to people who say that these things are happening. More concrete, stop listening to R. Kelly. Stop going to his shows. Stop supporting R. Kelly. Stop making excuses for R. Kelly. Because really all these excuses are just thinly veiled ways to uphold rape culture. That's all it is. So stop supporting these people. I mean, whatever happens with the law, we really can't control what happens with the law, but we can control how much money they get and how much we are perpetuating and promoting rape culture by supporting these people.
David Dennis Jr., thank you so much for joining us. Very illuminative on this issue.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We're gonna take one more break. We come back. Congresswoman, not elect anymore. She was just sworn in. Rashida Tlaib making big news for swearing about the president, triggering conservatives all across the country. We'll talk about why after this. We're like 24 hours into a new Congress and a lot of news being made, including by new Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who was speaking with a group of her supporters, and she used a curse word, as you'll see.
And when your son looks at you and says, "Mama, look, you won," bullies don't win. And I said, "Baby, they don't, because we're gonna go in there, we're gonna impeach the mother."
Damn. Okay, so everybody's losing their mind today now. I would argue they're not being genuine, but if we take them seriously, the right wing is shocked and chagrined over foul language coming from a politician. These Trump supporters will not stand for that, okay? And so they're very frustrated with Rashida Tlaib. Now, very few people seem interested in her actual argument that she's made, both in the rest of the video that nobody sees, but then also in an op-ed published today by the Detroit Free Press, which we're gonna have excerpts from. Before we get to that though, do you feel like she should immediately be booted from the House for swearing at that bar? I think it was a bar.
Is that a serious question?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, Dick Cheney swore on the floor of the Senate, right?
Yeah. He told Pat Leahy to go F himself.
I mean,
yeah.
Which is strong language. Literally, countries, like, that wasn't an issue, apparently.
Right. He said it about the great New York Times writer, Adam Clymer, great political reporter for years. You know, major league asshole was the line used there. big time, and one of them said.
Oh, yeah.
Big time, yeah. And, it's funny. Those are the things I like best about Dick Cheney.
You know, exactly. Well, and Dick Cheney later said that's one of the best things I ever did.
Well,
about that quote.
Oh, is that
Leahy?
Right? Yeah, right.
I mean, seems odd, but
right, I mean, they're debating important things. I mean, it's not a real debate with Dick Cheney because he's he epitomizes evil. But nonetheless, like, it's okay to tell another senator to go F himself. That's all right.
Yeah, and so here, like, this is going to be shocking to members of the press that are like, oh God, no, she swore. What she said and the tone she delivered it in and the reason she said it is reflected by a gigantic percentage of this entire country who are fed up with him. And not just on the surface stuff, the tweets, but the substance. So let's get into that. Her, Rashida Tlaib, or Representative Rashida Tlaib's op-ed in the Detroit Free Press. These are just excerpts. You can go and find the entire thing. But she said, "We already have overwhelming evidence that the president has committed impeachable offenses, including, just to name a few, obstructing justice, violating the emoluments clause, abusing the pardon power, directing or seeking to direct law enforcement to prosecute political adversaries for improper purposes, advocating illegal violence and undermining equal protection of the laws, ordering the cruel and unconstitutional imprisonment of children and their families at the southern border, and conspiring to illegally influence the 2016 election through a series of hush money payments." So that's a start. I mean, that's a few things. So it's easy to just say, hey, lady, no swearing. It's a little bit harder to rebut all of, I think, very good points she's making about at least we can have a conversation about things that seem like crimes.
Yeah, we don't need to wait for Mueller's report in the sense that we know enough about Donald Trump to warrant his impeachment. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, he might get impeached by this House. He's not going to get convicted by this Senate, barring a change in the political playing field. But I mean, what we already know is enough. I mean, it's written deliberately nebulous, high crimes and misdemeanors, right? Mm-hmm. So it's almost, that means whatever you think is worthy of being removed from office. It's not the worst thing in the world to be removed from office. You don't have a right to be president forever, right? And when you refuse to separate yourself from your business, when you profit off being the president, right? In addition to the litany of other things that we already know, right? So it's not that. That said, as Nancy Pelosi put it, I'm not in the censorship business. I don't like that language. I wouldn't use that language, but I wouldn't establish language standards for my colleagues. That's right.
That's a good answer.
That's right. Yeah, I think you should avoid saying mother effers.
Okay. Well, I don't say it on the show.
Right.
I get in trouble.
I just think, it's nothing wrong with saying we're going to impeach him. We're going to impeach him now. He doesn't deserve to be president of the United States.
Yeah.
But whatever. She got caught up in the moment.
And by the way, really fast, she agreed to some extent with you, saying whether the president was directly involved in a conspiracy with the Russian government to interfere with the 2016 election remains the subject of Robert Mueller's investigation. But we do not need to wait on the outcome of that criminal investigation before moving forward now with an inquiry in the House of Representatives on whether the president has committed impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors against the state, abuse of power, and abuse of the public trust. These are, of course, separate things. And I understand some people's response will always be, well, then you'll have President Pence. Okay, that is an accurate assessment, hypothetically, of the political outcome of doing what might be necessary, not in terms of political considerations, but in terms of the reality of crimes that have been committed.
Look, I mean, nobody knows for sure, but I'd rather run against Mike Pence than Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I would also argue, you know who's not in a powerful position? A president who got there because the guy above him was impeached.
That's right.
So bear that in mind. Now, Donald Trump responded saying, how do you impeach a president who has won perhaps the greatest election of all time? Done nothing wrong, no collusion with Russia. It was the Dems that colluded, had the most successful first 2 years of any president, and is the most popular Republican in party history, 93%.
I mean, so, I love it how you punctuate that for him, because that's not. I mean,
it's just a big blah.
And of course, full of wild untruths, including 93%.
But again, Donald Trump doesn't lie just to get you to believe the lies. He lies to get you to not believe in anything anymore. The idea that the Dems colluded. If he can get you to believe that, then he can get you to do pretty much anything.
He does make is one good point about being the most successful first 2 years of any president in American history. That's a good point.
Well, I mean, you can't argue against that. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Ben, for joining us. Always good to have you on. Thank you for watching. We'll be back next week with a lot more for you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.